Why, with Arcia Tekun.
Maloela Malie, Siotofa, good to have Tevita and Noke together. And Ata, we're missing you. But he was part of this project too. And we wanted to just talk a little bit about a paper that's going to be coming out finally. Indigenous Performances of Tongan Identity in Global Sporting Events.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's the one. That'll be coming out in Pacific Studies, based out of BYUH soon. And so I guess just to start us off, thinking about some of the background, we put together initial drafts probably early 2018, right? Just after the 2017 Rugby League World Cup. But yeah, I'll just turn it over to both of you. Whatever you want to share in terms of what you recall and remember from the background, why we were interested in recording this moment in time. And then maybe we can get into why it's taken this long to get published, which is actually not all on us, but turn it over to you two on that.
Yeah. So I remember the first time we were talking about the manuscript just after the 2017 Rugby League run by Matamata Tonga. And that was such a game changer within the Tongan community. I think everyone has known Tongans and rugby, specifically in rugby union, as kind of just the big bullies that really do the hard work on the field or on the pitch. And it was fun to see them in a different light in dynamic within rugby league due to the rule changes that happened right before the tournament, the cup started. But right after that, it just felt good, at least within the Tongan community. And it was nice to see that even in the larger Pacific community, people were very supportive and excited for Tonga's run, which ended in the semifinals. Controversial, not necessarily part of the paper, but contributes to a little bit of it as well. I just remember Daniel had called me and I was like, man, we got to write a paper on this. And I didn't really understand how we were going to approach this, but I was like, yeah, this would be definitely something to write about. Even if it was just as small as writing a social media post and kind of talking about the nuances there. But it was nice to see Daniel kind of push this along to try to really get it into an academic paper. And at that same time, you know, this is where we're engaging even Tevita to see if Tevita would have been interested to jump on the paper with us. And I think at this stage, Daniel, we were both still doctoral students.
Yeah.
And kind of still new to the whole publishing arena. And, you know, Tevita had already been kind of a big name, especially within our Tongan Pacific community, and just hesitant to see if you would want to join two junior scholars on this journey of trying to figure out how to publish. And I still remember me and Daniel collaborating, like, okay, is this right? Should we send this email to Tevita in this specific way? Do you think he'll respond? Or is this too formal? Should we not make it as formal? And then finally, Daniel finally sent it out. And man, same day, Tevita responded. So yeah, I'd be super interested to be on this. You know, let me read over what we got already, and then I'll give a response on Monday. I think me and Daniel talked with each other afterwards, and we were like, what? This is going to be cool, because one, not just that Tevita had the experience, but it was going to be nice for us to have the mentorship in terms of having access to someone that has done research and has published to kind of learn along the journey. So yeah, that's kind of some of the initial aspects of all of this. At the same time, sorry, I think because Atta's not here, I forgot to share how Atta was also a part of this. Atta was beginning his PhD journey. You know, he was a part of the conversations that we've all had around what was going on with Matimata Tonga. And, you know, we also looked at him as an individual that one could benefit from the publication, but also could give some really critical insights that could add some elements as we continue to construct this paper that we did. Yep.
Yeah. Man, that makes you remember. I feel like one of the things that we started with was just copying and pasting our messages. Because we had to look back like, man, we had already begun this analysis. And it's like, oh, let's just start with that. But I remember too, yeah, to see how much has happened since then, right? How mad we were to be like, man, we gotta, do you think DeVito will reply? And now we're like on, Talanoa all the time. But that time I remember we're just like, oh, still, baby scholars and trying to figure out stuff. But no, good memories, man, for sure.
Do you remember that moment, Devipa?
Oh yeah, I do. I do remember it. I still remember the email you sent to Daniel. And I was like really happy because I was already thinking that, there needs to be an article on this important issue. And I was happy that you and that Daniel and Inoke and Ata were already thinking about it and started writing. I was just writing posts on Facebook about it. And that was the way that I was trying to engage with it. And so when you send the invitation, Daniel, I was like, right on. I'm happy to be part of this and begin the process of writing something academic about the event 2017. My family's a big rugby, fan. We've been my dad used to take us to rugby games in Te Whaiwa back when we were young. And my dad played rugby also in our town team. So, I grew up, even though I grew up both in the US, but also in Tonga, rugby was always part of my, upbringing and used to play rugby with a lot of my friends at our house in Tonga. So we follow rugby, and that's rugby union, right? Before the rugby league that Tongan became part of it. But I was following everything that all of you were following, especially on social media, the way everyone was expressing pride and happy for our team, and then especially the players, these players that we all knew that could play for other team that had a lot of money but decided that they wanted to play for Tonga. And that was just exciting to see all that process manifest itself in like very global space. And then Tongans in Tonga and in the diaspora in New Zealand and Australia and Hawaii and Utah, California and Europe were all sort of kind of becoming part of it. I was part of a Tongan group on Facebook, Tongan Rugby Union group back in 2011 when Tonga went for the Rugby Union World Cup in New Zealand. That was like, I'd say the people in that group was like 20 to 30,000 that was on that Facebook group. That was a lot of people who were part of that. And so I think the momentum from there just sort of kind of carried on to the Matematonga Rugby League. And I think Tongans, whether you grew up with rugby or even if you just grew up, like especially in the US and you weren't really connected to rugby, you were still connected to rugby because family members and growing up, there were always rugby games that were going on in Sunggani in Salt Lake City, right? And so there was always that connection. Because I remember one of the critique that was launched against us is like these scholars from the US who know nothing about rugby. And that was launched by my cousin, not knowing that, whether we grew up in Tonga or grew up outside of the Commonwealth, in New Zealand, Australia, we were still very much connected to rugby. And so I was happy to sort of get together and write about that. But that was my memory, and I was happy to write with both of you because I always seen you two as important scholars, and it was great to collaborate on something. So
I think I'd been in New Zealand for about 3 years when that World Cup was happening, and Now I remember those points too. But yeah, so I was based in Aotearoa, and Ata had just arrived, and then you were in Hawaii. The Inoki was in Utah at the time, and so it was really fascinating to be like syncing up across these different, tava, these different time zones and multiple, senses of the meaning. I remember coming from the States, I remember to distinguish union from league, but here you don't even need to distinguish it. Rugby is just assumed to be union. There's rugby, that's rugby. So if you're talking about league, you just say league. And it's not usually as popular, right? But that was the other thing is in this context, right? Like all of a sudden league was just people who didn't always follow it because of the as far as the team was able to make it, making it all the way to the semifinals was massive. But I'm wondering if we maybe that's a bridge point of thinking about identity, right? Because that was a big one I thought was, a lot of the players were Aussie or New Zealand based folks. So predominantly Kiwis and Aussies in a sense. But playing for Tonga was like this huge thing to, in essence, like give up the amount of money they could have had access to play for the national teams of Oz and New Zealand that had a lot more resources. And so that was like that first act. So I'll leave it at that. Just have you respond, see what you want to say in terms of the significance of them playing heritage players playing for Tonga, and there was even like, tensions locally, because I think a lot of the Kiwis and Aussies, obviously, especially like Fifita and Tamalolo, were big players. And they were like, oh man, we're not going to have our stars. You're going to go play over there.
You know, the first thing I was thinking about, Daniel, is, we've been writing about the diaspora and remittances, right? That people were sending, working overseas and then sending money back home to Tonga. And what was pretty fascinating to me was this is sort of kind of another form of it, of people, instead of sending money, they're actually sending humans back to the homeland, in a sense that, and I thought that that was still very much Tongan in the sense of Tauhiwa, maintaining the ties, but not doing it with resources, and not doing it with monetary things, but now doing it with like human. Going back to represent the country and so forth. So I thought that that was very interesting to see that move that was happening. And I think our paper really gets into to some of the reasons behind that. But I was kind of following to see the many ways that that form of giving back that was coming in another form. To Tonga. And it was also because a lot of scholars were also asking at that time whether the second generation Tongan were going to do what their parents did about giving stuff back, right? Sending money back. And then the second generation, or maybe the third generations, were going to be just like, we're now in Australia or New Zealand, and we don't want to continue what our parents did. And so that the remittances was going to go down, and that the money was going to dry up and stuff, and here we see another form of that happening. So that was one thing that I was thinking about. It was kind of exciting to see that part.
Yeah, I remember, adding on to Terita, I think it was the Rugby League International Federation rule that said a player is eligible to play an international match for a nation in which either of his or her grandparents were born. And so that allowed for that opportunity for players overseas to be able to take on that opportunity to kind of represent the nations, the countries of where their grandparents were had citizenship with, even though they might not have had it themselves. So yeah, it's kind of a nice. I liked what you said, Tevita. You're going from this idea of monetary, like compensation or remittances, to individuals, like where we're switching this up, where it's not necessarily money, and not that. Not trying to use people as like products or compare it as like, oh, this is money. But like going back to what Daniel was saying, I'm kind of scrolling real quick, and I remember we wrote and shared about what Michael Jennings said in the paper. And I think he talked about this idea of like what's going to happen next after this run. And he said that he remembers when they lost against England. He said, Jason Tamalolo stood up and gave a speech saying he was staying with Tonga. Everyone went wild. Then Andrew Fifita stood up and said he was going to play his whole career with Tonga. Everyone went crazy again. Then one by one, each player got up and gave a speech from the heart and said that they would commit to Tonga. And that's such a really cool piece, because it shows like this is one way, even though one may not necessarily understand practices, protocols, language very well, this was something that was validated on a global scale of being able to give and offer something back to Tonga. And because of that, it sparked other things that happened in other Pacific nations. Just recently with the Samoa rugby team or rugby league team that went to the finals in England this past World Cup. That was a really cool thing. It was sad as a Tongan to see Tonga not make it to where we felt they should have been to and should have made it, but it was equally as felt good to see Samoa rise up to the challenge and be able to dominate to the point of almost getting a championship, you know, mm-hmm. the World Cup. But yeah, those are just some thoughts that I had on that.
I still remember all the places that I was during each of those matches too. And that semifinal, thinking about identity, and you did mention this, Noke, that it's not like a product, right? One of the things that we were trying to use to interpret was Borderlands Theory. And I know that that was one of the things that we tried a couple of journals that didn't want us to use that at all. And at that time, this was before Niume Tolu's thesis came out, where she as a Tongan uses Borderlands as well. And so I think that is helpful when you start seeing it referenced more. But because it was coming from a different context, we got kind of pushback. But I think it helps speak to that, where there is that double-edged thing of like, there's the remittances of the global economy on one hand. And on the other hand, it's people returning. And on the other hand, in the rugby, not just rugby, right? But in global sport, there is the commoditization of players and the need of players' unions and exploitation and all that in a variety of sports. But at the same time, there was something else happening, which was like that heritage players, right? Being able to connect to grandparent lineages and organizing symbolically something different. So it was almost like they were shifting the relationship to how people were coming to rugby as well. And one of the, I think still to this day, and if I ask my kids as well, one of the best family experiences we ever had was going to a Matamata Tonga game. And it's there's nothing like it. And I don't think I could expect that at any other game. I've been to a couple other games, which were so fun, but it's different. You go to Matamata Tonga, win or lose, you're going to have fun and it's going to feel safe because it's just the environment is so different. And then on top of that, in that moment of 2017, when they're winning and they're winning and they're getting further and further, it just kind of spread that. And I think the more that people were attending, not just to watch these phenomenal players, but I think this larger social phenomenon and experience of how Tongans celebrate. Yeah, again, the game that we went to was a one-off. It wasn't part of a league, but it was New Zealand against Tonga, and it was in New Zealand. But it felt like you were in Tonga. You might as well, it was like Tonga's home stadium. And at the same time, all the Tongans singing the national anthem for both countries, right? They're singing the Māori Waiata, and they're singing the Tongan Si'ilolo from Vava'u, right? Like, it's a combination of all of that. And it was just like, I've never had an experience like that in other sporting events, where there is that kind of collective frenzy and spirit that's unified in a very unique way.
There was I'm thinking when you add when he said I remember myself in every where I was at in every single game, the game that they played in New Zealand and won, which was at that time was the biggest win that Tonga had ever had. Leading up to that and during the game, I was at a wedding. I was at my cousin's wedding, and her mom is from New Zealand. Her mom she's actually related to Will Hopoate. And not just like the Tongan sense of like, oh yeah, we're related. Like everyone's my cousin. It was like a little relationship, like where her mom and I believe Will's dad are either siblings or first cousins, but it's really close relation. Anyways, she's having her wedding on the same day. I'm looking at all the tables. Everyone has their phone out, watching while listening to what's going on during the reception. The crazy thing is, even the wedding couple. It's their wedding day, and I think they were paying attention to what was going on with Tonga and New Zealand in this game. As soon as Tonga won, the MC takes over the mic and says, "Tonga beat New Zealand. Tonga beat the Kiwis." And the whole wedding just stopped. Like, I think, I don't know, the Matima Tonga song, one of the songs came on, and everyone in the whole like reception just started dancing, the line, the wedding couple were dancing crazy, and they came on. They're like, "We'll never forget this day. The day of our wedding was the day Tonga beat New Zealand." And that was just like a really surreal moment of seeing how sport interacts even within. This wasn't even a sporting event. This was a wedding. This was a family wedding, but yet the impact of what Matima Tonga had even penetrated this specific space of a wedding. And so looking at borderlands in that sense of like the not necessarily national borders, which we discuss and talk about in the paper, but like the borders of like how do you balance this idea of sport and identity, but also fulfill certain familial type of obligations and relational components there.
Yeah, and I think if you ask any Tongan, they can tell you where they were at when Tonga beat New Zealand. Everyone was following that game, whether on their phones or watching it, on TV. I was watching it at home and following social media simultaneously. And I got to a point I was so nervous. I didn't know what was gonna. I left and went. My wife is Māori, so this is even within our home we're having an interesting dynamic watching this game, right? So the borderland theory and Saldua is so great in sort of kind of capturing all these borders that are crossed and combined, and people within their family in the wedding. In all other relations, whether you are married to a Tongan or maybe you're married to someone who is from New Zealand or Maori, there's all that kinds of negotiation that's happening. But I could say that when Tonga won, it seemed like everybody was happy, right? My wife was happy. We were all happy because it was a moment to mark that Tonga has really come of age. In the world of rugby league, because once that happened, everybody knew, we have a team here that's really good. So I just wanted to say a little bit about that because you ask any Tongans, they'll tell you where they were at when they heard when Tonga won the game.
I want to ask a little bit about Faiva because I think that that's one of those other components. Like you said, like people, it's interesting to see how many people became fans who, maybe just because again, Tonga was not always getting like the same respect in the global sport arena, whether it was, rugby or league, and to see them just do really well. It's kind of like the ultimate underdog in the global arena. But then, like, just really punching above their weight in terms of not having the resources and compared to other teams and being able to get to those places. But I feel like there's this other thing too, right, of the way in which people engage with the sport, and it's so participatory, and that's something that we could say exists even beyond Tongans, because there's a lot of, sports fans, especially internationally, that really, participate in many different ways with it. But there is something very unique, I think, in the ways that Tongans do it. And part of that is the philosophy behind it. And I did want to bring this one up because out of all the podcast episodes that I've done over the last few years, the one we did, Tivita on Tavaism, the last I checked was the top one. And so there is interest in not just, you know, like these topics, but using, you know, those ideas to interpret what's happening, right, in this social phenomenon. And I love to think about things as faiva. To me, is like to see performance arts and to take performance seriously. You see it not just in what we might expect within like dance, let's say, but also to see it in sport, to see it in the way that fans participate in that sport. I mean, to be in a stadium where everybody is not just singing the same song, but they're singing it well.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And just to kind of add to the FIFA dimension of it, you know, this is where we look at the way that FIFA is used in creation of both Mali and Mafana, which is an, you know, central concept that we use in our paper to show how Tongan indigeneity is expressed. But, you know, to think of it as a particular performing arts, you know, takes it away from just thinking of it as a sport, but to see the way that everyone participate in a sporting event and sort of kind of the feeling of mafana that you feel even when you're watching it on TV, right? I, in the event, yes, definitely, for sure. But when you're watching it, you do feel the mafana, just hearing people singing the hymns and you sing along, you know, you are actively participating in a fiba, in a performing that is not just the player, but also the audience, and then the ones that are watching it through media, through a TV or so forth. Yeah.
I feel like as a Tongan, you are always in situations where you're performing or learning specific things. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know why you're learning something, but at some specific point, it's going to come handy. May it be at a wedding, may it be at some family event. In this scenario, it was rugby. And everyone used the same type of things that they had been kind of trained throughout their whole lives, singing hymns in church, you know, to bring that into a rugby game. That's, you know, why would anyone want to bring anything about church to a sporting event? Not that it's wrong or bad or anything like that. It's just, you know, who would ever think of singing a hymn at a rugby game and be so impactful, where you got a whole stadium, not even just the stadium, even us watching it on TV is singing like we're at the stadium and like imagining that we're there in the crowd in the Red Sea. Like, man, it was that moment where you're just like, man, I wish I was there. I wish I could see what that would be like. Because for some reason, even though I was miles away from where this was happening in Aotearoa, I still felt like I was like a part of it, you know. I think Moana said it best. Moana Uluave Hafoka, she said, it felt like Matima Tonga brought all Tongans and supporters. It like stopped time in a sense and brought everyone together. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. It was so simple, it was much better than what I said, but very simple in what she said. But it was like, man, I could feel that. I don't know. It was a very special moment. One that I try to take time to remember, to try to relive. But it was one of those where you just had to be there in the moment to understand what it was like. So trying to articulate what that feeling was like and trying to explain it doesn't do it justice at all. And I think we try to do it in the paper, and even trying to do this and relive the moments on this podcast, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to do, but it's a nice memory to have.
There's that power of that global kind of alignment in coming together at the same time. You know, like you mentioned that quote with Moana Uloava Hafoka, where it's just like, oh, it's like knowing you watched it, feeling like you watched it with like everybody, right? And you think about the population of Tonga and then the amount of the capacity that those stadiums have, and then to feel like every one of those is like a Tongan home game. Like sometimes it feels like, man, the quarter of the population is here, right? And then everybody else internationally is watching it at the same time. I think that's what makes it unique. There's fan bases all around the world with all kinds of different teams and sports, but in terms of like percentage of an entire population aligning together, I would venture to say I don't think anyone has done it like Tonga in that sense. Such a large percentage of your entire population globally supporting a event, and not just because it's about the players, but it's about so much more, I would argue, which is why it's so powerful. What else does it mean? I mean, what does it symbolize? Why is it so powerful? You know, and again, it's a fleeting thing. You know, the game ends and the game's over, right? The World Cup ends and the World Cup is over. What is it that makes it so powerful?
Yeah, I think this is where we were getting to the meat of our paper, of our article. And, you know, one of the things that we try to argue for was this express of Tongan indigeneity, right? That this was more than just being a nation and being a Christian nation, that there was this ties to the whanua that was all brought up in the game. And at that particular time, everyone was Tongan, whether you were born in Tonga or born outside of Tonga, or you could speak Tongan or not speak Tongan. You know, you could feel that there was something, you know, unique about this expression of Tongan identity through the performance, of course, of, you know, Malie, and then the feeling of Mafana. And we were just one whanua, the whanua in the sense that it is the land of Tonga, but also the people as whanua, right? And that everyone was connected to it, even though we were living in different boundaries, and those boundaries, you know, we were fine with living within those particular borders. And partly also was because the players were all outside of Tonga too. So it added to that moment that here is a moment where everyone really came to realize that we were just members of that particular whanua of Tonga. And I think that was what was happening that made it even deeper than just you know, that this was about the, yes, it was about the nation, but it was also about tying to some ancestral things that have been going on for quite some time. Because even the sort of like post about Kasiwaki, and you know, maybe I'll bring this up now. You know, the idea that we had our own form of underwater rugby, you know, all of those things came out, and they were sharing it on social media. There were all kinds of like sharing of things that for a while we didn't really think about, but now it was sort of like making this, hey, rugby has an ancestral connection for us. Or even when we're performing the Sipitau, that this was maybe a modern manifestation, but has deeper connections to some of our, you know, ancient Tongan or pre-colonial elements. So I think that's what it was. And I think people have different understanding of this. Maybe some people, I mean, we as scholars are like articulating this and say, oh yeah, this is about indigeneity and pre-coloniality. And we're using these terms, but I think the average Tongans may not be using the same terms, but they are experiencing it.
Yeah, this idea of like one whanua that Devita talks about, You know, I just learned this week of Devita shared what the word and term is for migration and diaspora, which is hikifonua. And that's such a really cool term. And when you're thinking about that idea of lifting of the land and knowing that people are also part of the land, and you're lifting that and placing that elsewhere, in a place outside of the motherland. Hikifonua, such a beautiful name for diaspora. And recognizing that, I don't know what it was, maybe there was a lifting of tapu or something like that, but it allowed, I think the players were able to experience the dream of a diasporic Tongan, because they're able to do something for Tonga without being judged for where they were born. Do they speak Tongan? Do they understand Tongan protocols? Do they understand Tongan practices? All these things, no one cared because they were on a national scale representing Tonga. Again, like I think what we're talking about is not necessarily tied to the national idea or country, but more of the essence of what Tonga has been pre-colonialism, you know? And so to me, I just was like, man, can my son have the opportunity? Because I think it's his grandfather. Or can my granddaughter, or my daughter, be interested in playing, or my niece or my nephew or somebody that I'm connected to? Would they be interested in being kind of like these individuals who pioneered this idea of playing for a place like Tonga? Would they be able to? What's crazy is seeing how big rugby is becoming, especially here in the US context. You know, 10 years ago, I remember helping coach the high school teams. And when I go back to Utah, I was like, man, there's like full on tournaments, and everyone is represented really well in terms of rugby there. And now that I'm here in Hawaii, you know, seeing it at a very young age where you have U8s and U10s, U12s, U14, 16, and it's a crazy thing. And I was like, man, maybe in the future, there's a chance where Tonga's national team will have someone from the U.S. Participating in kind of helping those that have come from Australia and New Zealand. And even in Tonga, maybe the Tonga just takes over and they have a lot of people in-house, but they don't necessarily need as much support or help from outside and can continue that. Whatever that may be, I think to me is just this idea of being one for Noah was a really cool feeling, and it wasn't exclusive. It was an inclusive opportunity. So again, even if you weren't even talking, you still felt like you were part of Tonga, man. And that was, to me, it was nice to have that moment where no one was subjected to kind of any judgment in a sense.
Mm. Because you brought it up, I wanted to share a little bit about some of the things that we had on Kasivaki. Just, we want to encourage people to read the article, of course, but sharing a couple of things for folks, hopefully to encourage them too, or also just kind of compliment it as well. So I was going to do, I'll do the two records that we have of like outsider observations, and then I'll pass the rock back to yous. But one of the things that was great to have Devita on board with this is, he was able to also bring in Tongan resources that are written in Tongan, and being able to incorporate that really, you know, adds another layer of depth to understanding this, right? Because I remember hearing stuff like, oh, you ever heard about this underwater rugby thing? And it was almost like in echoes and whispers. And then all of a sudden it's coming to the prominence that people are making Facebook posts, like you mentioned. And so the first one I'll reference is actually from Tokyo Kamea or William Mariner. And this is, again, slightly edited, but this is how he explained Kasivaki in terms of how he observed it. And this is in the early 1800s, before it stopped being played. So he says, quote, "They have a sport. It consists in carrying a large stone underwater 10 feet deep from one post to another at the distance of 70 yards. The party carries the stone running along the bottom. The difficulty is to pursue a straight course. A person may thus run twice as fast as another can swim. Close quote. And then I'll let you all fill in with the Punga Tea and Punga Kapa and some of the other Tava symbolism here. But I was just going to read the other observation, which is a little bit earlier, late 1700s, just turning to the 1800s, by George Vason or George Vasan, who was a British missionary in Tonga. So this is, you know, a decade or two before Tokyo Kamea. And there's a little bit more detail that he offers, which I think offers another interesting kind of point too. So in his one, it says, quote, both sexes often play together in the water at the following diversion. They fix two posts about 100 yards distant from each other in a depth of water about 4 feet near the shore, and midway betwixt them is placed a large stone. Then dividing into two companies, the game is which side can first tug the stone to their own post. In playing at this diversion with them, I have seen numbers at the bottom of the water together, hauling and pulling the stone different ways, with all the eagerness that contending parties in the northern countries of England exert themselves to drive the shinny to its goal. When a diver returned to the surface for breath, another of his party instantly dived down to take his place. I have seen one person carry a stone a considerable weight, 10 or 12 yards in this game, through the buoyant aid of the water. Close quote. So interesting component that he adds to it is it doesn't seem to have been gendered either. There's not a whole lot of detail beyond that, but that's another interesting component, which I think was observed by other outsiders as well. And the reason we look to those is because so many of the records were destroyed internally in the construction of the nation state. But there wasn't that same kind of, you think about the gender politics in sports, especially in the West, this was not an issue in ancient Tonga. And so it's fascinating to draw from that. But I'm wondering if you all mind adding some, we'll start with you, Tevita, because again, your insights being able to bring in Masiu Moala's work on, you know, how Matemata Tonga is not just a metaphor, it was like a literal, I mean, I'll let you explain it.
Yeah, you know, Masiu Moala is considered to be, you know, someone who's very knowledgeable on Tongan culture. And he writes only in Tonga. His book, Efinanga, is a book that's only in Tongan. Hopefully someday someone will translate it to English so that others can have access to it. But I know, his explanation of Kasivaki comes from, and Masiu Moala was also a member of the Tonga Traditions Committee, which is the committee that was formed by Kunsalote to, have these scholars and elders who are knowledgeable of Tongan culture start to collect some of these old traditions and stories and so forth. So Masiu Moala was one of the members, and he gave his own explanation. But he said Kasivaki was played by the Tautai, which is kind of the sea warriors or the seafarers, and they play this game for the Tuitonga, the, you know, the paramount chief or the, you know, monarch of Tonga at the time. just kind of to, you know, the Kasivaki was, you know, about brave and courageous demonstration of physical stamina. This is just kind of reading a little bit from our paper here. And then it was basically sort of kind of, you know, performing a ukuloloto, which is, you know, diving deep into the ocean. There were two teams. He wasn't know about the exact number. The undersea field was marked by a tupunga, a punga. Punga is a soft, compact coral stone. One on each. One was pungatea, punga kapa. So one was sort of kind of to mark these coal posts. And then, according to him, there were two stone balls, one white, one black. So one team carried the white ball and the other carried the black and the black ball, and they were trying to sort of kind of run it to the other side to score, right? And so the two teams were trying to defend their their goal posts while the other teams are around. And it seemed like they were happening simultaneously. So it'd be interesting to see how this game work, right? It's the people are running and then others are defending and that all of that are happening together. And I, you know, from Tava's stuff, we've been thinking about black and white as these like two colors that always intersect and, you know, represent sort of kind of male and female. So it was interesting to sort of kind of think about how that might also be used in the creation of this game. But that's pretty much what Masimwala's recollection of Kasiwake.
The only thing to add on is what you were going to be saying, Daniel, about Matematonga, where players potentially had, they would probably risk their lives in playing this game. And so you would pretty much die if that, you know, was the case. And so, again, we don't know or, you know, unsure, but the slogan or the theme of Matema Tonga, die for Tonga, could have potentially been something really real for a lot of these players that participated in Kasiwake.
Yeah, and according to Masimwala, there were, you know, death was part of this game. You know, people died all the time. And it was, you know, one of the way to show, you know, your warriorness or bravery was to die, especially playing the game and honoring the Tuitonga and so forth. So there is some, you know, connection perhaps between Mate Matonga and the death that happened while playing Kasiwake.
That sacrifice, eh? And so it were today, right? Mate Matonga literally died for Tonga, but, you know, maybe more commonly interpreted as to give your all for Tonga. But there's this metonym, right, that extends into the metaphor of today. If you drowned by pushing yourself to the limit, I mean, you were dying for Tonga in that. And it's not an uncommon thing in ancient sport throughout the world, you know, to think about the role that sport plays in societies. I could talk to you all for ages, and I know we could talk about this for a long time. Any other things that you would like to comment on, you know, as we wrap it up, about the paper or other things that maybe we didn't cover in it that we, you know, just to be thinking about?
I think for me, it was great to see. I think there was another paper that came out right before us by Dion Anari, and he had written about Mate Matonga from a different perspective. And I think for me, it's just excited to see what more could be published on the topic. You know, what more do other people see, perspectives that we didn't even cover or, you know, didn't recognize. And hopefully others will want to share and write about this. I think, is it Kalolaine from Aotearoa who talks about women and rugby league and rugby in general? You know, that's a whole nother nuance of the sport, as well as aspects that are connected to Tonga that will be interesting and fun to read and get to know in terms of her research. But I think for me, it's just looking forward to see what other people have to contribute or even push back against in regards to what we wrote, and just create that critical dialogue that I feel like is much needed within the Tongan space.
Goyape. And I think for me, one of the aspects that we really focused on in our paper was Tongan indigeneity, which we've gotten a lot of pushback. And, you know, my book is marking indigeneity, so I'm part of the problem that have created this use of indigenous framing of Tongans, because some of the pushback were, you know, can Tonga use this idea of indigenous or even indigeneities, since Tonga was never colonized or did go through settler colonialism and so forth. But I think we set it up pretty nice in our paper. And then you have to read Daniel and Ata's paper to also get the other perspective of Tongan coloniality. And I because, you know, this idea of indigeneity is a very it's a concept that people are using more and more. And I think the way that we lay it out in our paper is that not only that many of us are living in settler colonial society, but Tonga did go through a process or still today under coloniality, you know, through the power structure or power patterns of colonization. And I think that's a useful way to sort of kind of frame things, but it also allows us to tie our, you know, what we're doing as Tongans to other indigenous movement around the world and in the globe. So I think that's sort of kind of last thing I want to share for us to maybe think about.
Pagafetaia, maluapito.
Oh, fato.